Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, community radio by and for the people, broadcasting at 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Independent Media Center, or WRFU, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. And you're listening to Radio Free Urbana, and we've got and the World Labor Hour. And we're going to be having several guests today. We got a couple guests here live in the studio that we're going to introduce in a moment. And then we got two guests calling in, one at 11:30. That guest is Randall from the he's a National Secretary Treasurer of the Industrial Workers of the World, calling in from Chicago to talk about various their organized objectives coming up in the coming year. And at 12 noon, Mark Dudzik, the National Organizer for the Labor Campaign for Single Payer, who will be talking about he's calling in from Washington, D.C., and he's going to be talking about the upcoming conference in New York City in January and their strategy for 2017. And now some underwriting announcements from Gus.
This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of community and union groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice hosts regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. The Graduate Employees Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but to also give solidarity and support to unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is also supported by Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This hour of programming is supported in part by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of over 7,000 workers in Champaign County and over 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support the World Labor Hour and community radio in East Central Illinois. The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. The CFA is proud to support community radio and the World Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting cfaillinois.org. The Illinois Single Payer Coalition is proud to sponsor the World Labor Hour on WRFU-FM. The Illinois Single Payer Coalition believes that healthcare is a human right and is dedicated to expanded and improved Medicare for all. For more information, go to IllinoisSinglePayer.org.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And so I'll just at this point have our two guests introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Dean Dempsey. Yat eh, Dean Dempsey in Shedok. To bla ishtagi do yat eh. Additional to akhah.
Hi, my name is Harry Michelide. I'm a graduate student in physics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and founder of a campaign called STEM Boycotts the War Machine.
Okay, and so I've asked both of you to come on the show today because you both have, even though you never met each other until just about 10 minutes ago, the thing you have in common is that you both have just returned from the Standing Rock Resistance in North Dakota. And I'd love to have you guys kind of share your stories. We'll start with you, Dean. Tell us about, just whatever your impressions were.
Yeah. I showed up on a Sunday afternoon and with a friend, and after setting up the tent, I went and explored, and I noticed that everybody that I came in contact with made eye contact and said hello and either shook my hand or hugged me and said thank you for coming and thank you for being here to support what's going on and protecting the water. And after being there and meeting all these wonderful people who have a goal of protecting, like the Lakota people say, is seven generation ahead, and that's where we should be protecting the water for the seven generations, and just understanding that as Native people, we are connected, and as people of this earth. We are connected to this earth. We are made from this earth. Every part of us comes from this earth, and even in the Bible says we are made from this earth. And so, as human beings, we should always be connected, because what we do to this earth is what we do to ourselves. And the more we destroy our mother and hurt her, is our faith is we're destroying ourselves, and that's what this is about. And there's a lot of reports or a lot of things I hear people who don't educate themselves about the situation, or just don't understand, or get very little news and say, well, you know, you're driving a car, or, you know, that car is made out of oil because all the plastic is made out of oil. But we need to change as a people to different types of energy that Earth provides for us. And, you know, it's there. We just need to harness it like we harnessed oil.
Okay, Harry, did you want to kind of maybe add to that, since you're actually a PhD student in physics, and, you know, I mean, talk about your experience, of course, but maybe you could start by adding to what Dean said. Is that technology is there, right, that we could start making a transition?
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'll get into technology for a second.
Okay.
I also had the same experience of people being friendly and, like, moments of deep compassion coming actually very, very easily. When we drove into the camp, me and the people in my van, I started to tear up, because something about the place really struck something deep inside of me. I believe there's a sense here, just walking around, your average person sees things as sacred, which is a feeling you don't really get, I don't know, walking around any average town in America. A sense that sometimes silence is called for. And of course, everyone is there to oppose this pipeline, so everyone's coming in with a mission. Something that's deeply important to them. I should also add, just about every emotion runs high. I had a lot of really, really great encounters, but there's some distrust at the camp too. There's almost certainly informants for the pipeline in there, so you have to be kind of hushed when you're talking about, say, oh, there's going to be an action at 4 p.m. You can't really just go around saying exactly what you feel and what's going on. And also there's some sense, I've heard a few people talk about people coming in and just trying to get a look and, like, have an experience and sort of soak it up. So there's a few comments about, like, hey, if you're, like, not putting in the work, like, this is really not the place for you. So every emotion is on high. Let's see. When it comes to technology, I mean, there are so many options moving forward. There's solar, there's wind power, there's geothermal. There's also, if we really wanted to dig in, what we could do is, and this clues into the campaign I started called STEM Boycotts the War Machine, if we took this massive $600 billion a year military budget, and that's just America, and even just carved out a portion for it, for a clean energy transition, and say a permaculture transition, we could make massive gains, and we would make massive gains. When the scientific community digs into something, whether it was the atom bomb or going to the moon, it happens. It's almost magic, but it's incredible. It happens. If we had that same kind of drive to go to the moon to create a clean energy system, it would, I am positive it would happen.
But a lot of these drives that happen in American history have always been tied directly to capitalism or some type of power usurpation from another group of people. These technologies that exist as wind and solar power that we've known to have exist for over decades at this point now, we know for a fact that it will benefit not only people, but also help try to restructure the damage that we've done to the earth.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. And that's why it has to be, for these technologies to come into power, it has to be pushed for and made happen by a coalition of people. It's not going to come from those in power, because it does not benefit those in power.
Exactly.
Let me amend that. I think it would benefit everybody, but I think people are very confused about what they really want in life, and people in power are confused. They think power and money is what's going to give them happiness. And so that's what they pursue.
So, Dean, you were talking a little bit before the program about when you first arrived. I mean, maybe you could kind of share that experience as far as, you know, when you said that when you came to the camp, how kind of things were organized, and also, you know, your first encounter when you actually first saw the front lines, if you will.
Okay. The first day I was there, like I said, I met all these people. And next morning was where I really met more people and experienced the front line. We get there in the morning. There's a crackle and there's a thump from a speaker, and the announcer is a Lakota man, and he says, "Wake up, everybody! Wake up, pipe carriers! Wake up, sun dancers! Wake up, Christians! Dust off your Bibles, polish your crosses, and it's a good day to be alive." And so, and it starts with prayers and songs, and they ask people to come and sing their morning prayer songs, or say a prayer in your language, and they invite everyone to come. And not everyone's a morning person, so there's not a lot of people up there at that time. And so after that, they go into this geodome, and some people are split up, and they have some people go to a protest where they learn how to protest safely, and they're
nonviolent.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And
that's easier said than done, of course. That's, that takes some training and discipline.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And after that, they're given a sheet of paper, or even before, to fill out to identify themselves. So if they're arrested, and the paper asks also if you're arrestable, then this is where you sign, and this give your identification, and they write a phone number on your arm, because it's been known and it's been reported that Mandan and Bismarck police have been strip searching people and putting them in dog kennels and
unbelievable,
leaving them naked without any of their clothes, or, you know, and that's just a part of their tactics. And so afterwards, and then they have people who don't want to leave the camp, or who are just there who want to help, and they're there to chop wood, to haul water, to clean up the camp, and you have people who have talents in construction, or, you know, heating places with less wood, or, you know, different ways to heat buildings. So they're there, and there are people helping each other all the time. And when I was there, I also helped construct little security huts, and we built that into the night, and with little lights on our heads, and we probably had two of them, so we kept passing around this little flashlight, and throughout the night it got dimmer and dimmer. So by the time we screwed in the last screw, the battery just died, and we're like, "Hey, we made it."
Okay. And then you were describing about the first day, or the first time when you actually walked towards where the main front lines or confrontation with the police is. I mean, that was a really vivid description. If you could share that with the listeners.
Sure. I walked over a hill that went to the bridge on 1806, Highway 1806, and that bridge was, to me, when I first saw it, really took me back, because it looked like something from TV or from a news report, where they've been battling other Native people for their lands, or, you know, they're battling for something, and there's tanks, and there's police, and, you know, there's razor wire, and there's concrete blocks sitting on this bridge, and these burnt out military trucks that are for the police safety, they say. But it was really eye opening and scary, and it was unbelievable that this would be going on in this country, where our veterans have fought for freedom and fought for our right to protest or have a voice in this country that really never gave us that option. The treaties that have been signed, even before the ink was dry, they violated. And the treaty, the Laramie Treaty of 1861 was violated within a few months. They dammed up that river and flooded part of the reservation, and the Army Corps came in and took that part where the Otsetshikon camp is now, and where DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline, is at, is reservation land. And but they've taken that away, and so really it's where they're at is native lands.
Okay. Now, you talking about veterans, I mean, you were telling me too before the show that there's going to be a contingent of veterans going out there to actually stand with the water defenders.
Right. His name is, I think, Chris. He's a veteran, and his dad was also, I think it was a general. And he got together with other veterans around the country, retired veterans, retired firefighters and police department. And they're coming to North Dakota to stand with the people. And their plan is to walk to the area where they're going to drill and put the pipeline across the river and retake that area. And so they're going to be there for a few days, and they're going to show up. The plan is December 4th, and I encourage all veterans to participate, and please help us to...
Yeah, I see here that U.S. Representative Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii and retired Baltimore police officer whistleblower Michael Wood are some of those people that are planning to attend.
Yes.
With that a contingent. Okay.
Good.
All right.
Yeah, and there's a Facebook page, Veterans for Standing Rock.
Facebook page, Veterans for Standing Rock.
Yes.
Okay.
And it says here it's had more than 600 confirmed reservations, with more than 4,500 other people expressing interest.
Wow. Okay.
Nice.
Okay, Harry, do you want to add to, you know, tell what your experiences were, if you will?
Oh, sure. I guess I'll jump into my experience of the front lines. I think it was, it was Sunday night, I'm pretty sure, before dinner. I didn't get a chance to eat dinner because the call went around camp. Everyone to the bridge, you know, all water protectors to the bridge. I looked around for any people who I'd come with. I couldn't find them, so I left a note in my tent saying, hey, I went to the action. I caught a ride, and I was there. I was on the bridge. There was lots of people. Occasionally people would be like, clear the road so a medic vehicle could come through. There was medics. There was people like walking around with tear gas in their eyes and calling for a medic and getting their eyes. They were doused with a milk of magnesia. I kept pushing forward. I felt a call to get right up to the front line, so I kept making my way. And there it was. Had a razor wire, like a 5-foot coil of razor wire, and behind it was a long line of cops with riot shields. In the center behind the blockade was an armored vehicle with a cop on the top with a water cannon or maybe a fire hose, and spraying people with it, spraying anybody he could with it. You had cops.
How cold was it?
It was below freezing temperature. Shit. Yeah, it was below freezing temperature. And you had cops with guns with rubber bullets who'd walk up to the razor wire and raise it and say, get back! And then, you know, you'd kind of like walk back a little bit. The cop would walk to another area. You'd kind of like walk back there and then walk back to the blockade. I got to breathe tear gas for the first time. They were just like launching these tear gas canisters way, way high up in the air, and they'd come down. I know one woman got hit in the face. Man, like one woman got the shrapnel from a concussion grenade. She had to have part of her, she might have to have part of her arm amputated from this action. Tons of people getting hypothermia. And, you know, I've always known that, you know, don't trust your government, don't trust police. It's kind of always been clear, but to actually be a part of this, this action, and then the next day to see all the news stories coming out, and what, like, the cop going to the Morton County Sheriff's Department page, and seeing how they're describing this event, it's almost comical. And, like, I'm really trying to internalize just how different their account was. Like, they say protesters were very aggressive and it was a riot. Most people were standing still and kind of milling around and still being sprayed and shot and breathing tear gas. They said they, at one point they tried to say, we were using the water cannon just to put out fires. There's plenty of, there's too much footage for that too. they amended it, because there was too much footage to hold, exactly. Hold that lie. Yeah, and like that woman who got her arm amputated, they said nothing we did could have done that to her. And I, after just seeing them fire and fire and fire things, and like even testing out their long range acoustic device, which is meant to disorient you with a high pitched, high volume sound, and like for them to keep up this idea that they were just defending themselves when like one police officer got hit with a bottle. But, like, multiple people on our side caught hypothermia, and, like, three or four people I know got like, actual serious, like, real injuries. So, you know, some of us got hurt, I hope, but, like, to I think this confrontation, I know it means something, and I'm glad that people got to see it across the country and across the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, I don't know. I don't watch corporate media. Bill or Gus, have you seen, are they even covering this at all anymore? Because I know it was quite a blackout for quite a while.
When you go to a lot of the corporate media pages now, they put it towards the bottom of the page. I know CNN has something at the very, you know, they have those subsections at mm-hmm. If you go to the half of the page. They have Standing Rock at the very bottom on one of their subsets. But places like Huffington Post had something recently. They're kind of okay with doing things every once in a while. I didn't see anything on New York Times. Mm-hmm. I didn't see anything on MSNBC. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there is somewhat of a blackout on Standing Rock right now.
Of course, this is all over social media. You know,
oh, yeah, everywhere. It's everywhere.
And the alternative media, everything from Democracy Now! To, you know, what have you out there that's broadcast either on internet, TV or regular TV or radio or what have you. So, I'm afraid we're just about running out of time. Dean and Harry, could you just make like maybe a couple, just a real short last statement of what, you know, what you think, I don't know, just whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. Well, I just want to say please support the camps. You can go to sacredstonecamp.org, ochoshikowincamp.org, Red Warrior Camp on Facebook. You spell Oche Sikowin by OCETISCKOWIN. That's Seven Council Fire for it's a Sioux language. And pray for these people, and pray that the government and DAPL or the police soften their heart and open their eyes to what's going on, and that they would stop what they're doing and take the time and the moment to listen to Mother Earth, and to listen to our Father, that the Creator that created everything on this earth, to so we could live here and be as one family, and we're all related.
Okay. Harry?
Thank you for that, by the way. Yeah, a couple things. I think the best action to help for those not in North Dakota would be to go to Defund DAPL. Just search that. Defund DAPL. You can find a list of banks that are supporting the pipeline. And then there's a way to then, you know, undo your bank account, and there's a way to hashtag it properly and to make it public, such that you join the thousands of people who are part of that. And another thing too is this camp. It's kind of, so I'm sort of an anarchist, and it's kind of anarchy in the best sense of the term, and it's every person there has to figure out for themselves where they're needed and how to spend their days. And there's no authority. There's leadership, and there's people you can trust and follow, but you have to figure out for yourself who to trust and who to follow. It's self-determination, and it's everyone acting together in faith to make this work. It's not just a protest. It's also like actually really building the new society, the one we need. So it was a very powerful experience.
Wow, that's really interesting.
A temporary autonomous zone.
A temporary autonomous zone?
Yeah, that's a common term in
I like that.
Anarchism.
Okay. Yeah. And we just found out that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is moving towards kicking the protesters out of the main North Dakota camp. Yep. I guess December. Their deadline's December 5th. So it looks like come December 5th, as opposed to Obama intervening and helping, he's going to send in the U.S. military to work against the protesters. Not that we weren't surprised about that. But a lot of people out there were, you know, had a lot of delusions that was going to happen. But, you know, unfortunately. But you know what? The fight's going to continue here because this is not going to go away. I mean, they can close down that camp. They can burn it down, arrest everybody, run them off. It's going to reform because we've got to protect. I mean, this struggle is so huge on so many different levels. So, Dean and Harry, thank you so much for coming in today. Yeah, real quick, Bill.
Okay. This is a news release from the Morton County Sheriff's Department. Quote, today's multiple protest events on Thanksgiving Day were no surprise to our law enforcement team, said Morton County Sheriff Kyle Kirchmeyer. Quote, these paid agitators and protesters exerted to try and draw our law enforcement into confrontations did not work. We will respond in kind to any advances protesters make on our line. It's their decision. They can bring an end to this. How much did you guys get paid? And did George Soros personally come out and write the checks to you?
That's the most absurd thing. Thank you for sharing that, Bill. It's really important. So thanks again, Dean.
Well, this paid protesters thing is comes out all over the place.
Yeah. I see that everywhere, too.
Okay, thanks again, Dean and Harry. And you're listening. And you're listening to the World Labor Hour. One more thing to say.
It's water protectors, not protesters.
Okay, I'm sorry, water protectors, yes.
Actually, it's world protectors, but the water brings it home where people can relate to it.
Indeed. Okay, well, thank you again so much for coming on. You're listening to World Labor Hour on the Support Community Radio Station, WRFU 104.5, and stay tuned.
In legislation's on the desk of a dear-eyed congressman. He don't know much about the issues, so he picks up the phone and asks the advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies, ripping off what's left of the reservation. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. That's sending federal tanks. It is a nice, but it's reality. Baby, my heart had wounded me. Congress, who wants to take the land? And we got churches by the dozen trying to guide our hand. And turn our mothers over to pollution, war, and greed. Oh, and my heart had wounded. Get nailed. Still, then I felt here goes off the jail.
And you know, this
is okay, we are back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, and that was the Indigo Girls, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And the last lyric of that song, yes, Leonard Peltier, there's another political prisoner. A lot of people were hoping Obama would give clemency or a pardon to, along with Mumia. I don't think that's going to happen, not at all. That's going to, if that would happen, if Obama would do that, he would just ruin his post-presidential consulting and speaking career.
He's going to charge at least probably $100K per speech. He's going to go on the tour. Now we're hearing that he's buying all this property up out in California now, and he's trying to become this kind of conglomerate. Just entrepreneur type figure now. He doesn't want to mess that up.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we saw who Bill Clinton pardoned in his last term. Mark Rich, that financier that cheated all those, I think it was steel workers, yeah, out of their pension money, plus was liable for all sorts of safety violations and stuff. And, that's somebody that the president will pardon. But forget about somebody that's in jail on a political frame-up, like Leonard Peltier, Mumia Abdul-Jabbar, or Ashada Shakur, who's still Cuba, was framed up. There's people don't realize that we've got over 100 political prisoners in this country that have been designated so by Amnesty International.
Exactly. And listeners, make sure you stay tuned towards the latter half of the show, where we will be breaking down analysis of Castro's life, who passed away yesterday. So
yeah. Indeed. Okay, just to let you know some quick public service announcements. Stay tuned on WRFU for another sports show, A Radical Look at Sports, with host fellow worker Neil Parthen. That's from 2 to 3 here at WRFU 104.5. And tune in tomorrow and every Sunday for Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. Tomorrow's episode is the 2013 SEIU strike here in Champaign-Urbana.
Oh, good.
And dedicated the whole rest of the year to various videos about resistance and direct action, because next Sunday, a week from this Sunday, is the 2008 GEO strike here.
That's
at
right.
The University of Illinois. Direct action gets the goods. The following Sunday is the Workers' Republic, about the Republic Windows and Doors occupation in Chicago, just 3 weeks before the GEO won their strike, mm-hmm. in which the workers were going to be cheated out of their, they're told to they're going to lose their jobs and everything else, and they occupied the factory. They took it over. And, they called the police, and a huge number of people from the community in Chicago turned out and basically stood between them and the police. And in 5 days, they got everything they wanted. And after that, we're going to show the Minneapolis General Strike of 1934. And then, of course, the UAW, back when it was a great union, the 1930s, yep. all the occupations of Ford and General Motors that won them union recognition. I think we're coming into this new era, if you will, of where the empire has, since we spit in the face of the good cop, now that the bad cop's coming in the room with the brass knuckles and the rubber hose, we need to really start learning these lessons from the past about how we need to resist.
Of course, definitely. This is a current moment in time. If you understand how the neoliberalization process, how it operates, then you understand that dialectics is a major component of how to deal with neoliberalization. I make sure I don't say neoliberalism, because it's a completely different theory than the actual process that the capitalists have used to dispossess people around the country and the world. And the big thing that we have to understand is that resistance has to be communal. Mm-hmm. We have to understand ourselves as oppressed communities, and break these walls of this idea of, just because you're in a different state or if you're in a different area, that you're a different person. We have to look at the Huey P. Newtons and really study what he meant by revolutionary intercommunalism. How do you build and strengthen your community? How do you develop a resource? How do you develop internal resource supply lines to protect and strengthen those of us who don't have the necessary material conditions? How do you defend your community and your people from outside vigilante state-sponsored violence? You build neighborhood militias. You do those types of things. I mean, there are so many different things that can start being built across the country and in other parts of the world, to where we can prepare for a really serious policy of austerity that's going to happen. You know, when you actually look at the more recent updates to Trump's cabinet, you know, I mean, things are getting just worse and worse. I mean, you thought last week was bad. The things that are happening now in terms of education, you know, Trump, one of the big things that Trump has repeatedly stated, and he has not wavered on this a bit, is how he wants to crush public education. I mean, that's something that he's talked about in terms of he has no respect for the Department of Education. So, of course, he brings in somebody who is anti-public education to be the head of Department of Education. So another billionaire, of course. So he chose longtime Republican donor Betsy DeVos. DeVos personifies what really is the epitome of ruling class bourgeoisie anti-public education, anti-working class politics.
Okay, I believe that's our caller.
I don't know if those work.
Hello, WFU, you're on the air. Hello, WFU, you're on the air. Okay, folks, I don't know. Hopefully we don't have a problem with the phone lines here. That might have been our caller. But anyway, Harry decided to – our guest decided to stay around, and I'd like to encourage him to, you know, jump in and be part of the program if you'd like. And Bill's back. Okay, let's try this again here.
No try.
Seize the day.
Hello, WFU, you're on the air. Okay, folks.
Well, more about the votes.
Yes.
While we wait for the call. The votes led an organization that calls for the reinstatement of child labor. From 1995 to 2005, she sat on the board of directors for the Acton Institute and has given $1.28 million to support the organization that calls for the reinstitution of child labor since 2000.
Hello, WFU. Okay, caller, if you can hear me, Randall, I don't know what's going on with the phone lines, so I don't know what to tell you at this point. We seem to have a problem with not getting your call here actually to come through on the soundboard, so my apologies. But anyway, Gus, yes, please go ahead.
So DeVos, and here's what's interesting. On November 3rd, 2016, there was a blog posted for the same organization that she supports and has been an avid proponent for. Quote, work is a gift our kids can handle. End quote. And then the blog goes on. It talks about looking at photographs of young children with their faces covered in coal dust. Quote, that these pictures of children, and we're talking about children as young as 5, 6, and 7, quote, represent the faces of those who are actively building enterprises in cities, using their gifts to serve their communities, and setting the foundation of a flourishing nation in turn. End quote. So if you
sickening.
Yeah, if you know anything about how capitalism has transformed over time in U.S. history, one of the biggest things that we recognize is that children, particularly of the working class, their parents make them make a decision of either going to school or going to work, and many of them chose to go to work. And so what you have here is a complete hatred of education, and that she wants children to work instead of going to school. So you have this person who was in charge of the Department of Education. Besides that,
yeah,
in 1993, for decades, she's been involved in the conspiracy to abolish public education and turn it into a cash cow for her billionaire private school and charter school profiteer friends. And that's a big thing that she's known for, is being this pro charter school profiteer who's established across networks across the country.
Yeah, just for, so people know that the current head of the Department of Education, Arne Duncan, was appointed by Obama, comes from Chicago, and was one of the main architects there of basically defunding public schools and pushing in corporate charter schools. So it sounds like, and he had no
Sounds pretty bipartisan to me.
Yeah. He never taught a class. He never had a teaching degree. Arne Duncan, that is. Yeah. No background education. He was a basketball player, you know. Yep. That was good enough for then Mayor Richard Daley and then later Rahm Emanuel. And then President Obama appointed him to the head of the U.S. Department of Education.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at all the experience at this DeVos. Has, which is none.
Yes,
none. Right, you absolutely. Know, and her family made their money on basically a pyramid scheme.
Exactly.
Amway.
Yeah,
that's it. Oh, really? They're out of the Amway.
That's her family.
The only attachments that she has to education is that she funds these charter school programs and these charter school upstarts, mm-hmm. and that's it. She has no direct ties to education whatsoever, yeah. other than
she never
money.
Went to public school
herself.
Her kids never went to public school.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're going from bad with Arne Duncan to worse with this woman DeVos.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. the material conditions continue to deteriorate. People, I keep seeing these insane people talking about give Trump a chance, give Trump a chance. That's all you keep hearing, and most of it's coming from the liberals, particularly the Democratic Party is very big on going out there and saying, let's work with Trump. And then you hear the soft liberals, the petty bourgeoisie saying, well, there are things that we can do to get reforms about Trump. No, when you select your cabinet and when you look at any system of oppression throughout world history, well, the first thing you look at is you look at the staff.
Yes.
Whoever they put in the staff is who they're making that they're trying to make a statement to the people of what type of system they're going to run.
Right. With Jeff Sessions, we're going to have a racist government.
Yeah.
Because Jeff Sessions is racist.
Yes.
Jeff Sessions was denied a judgeship by Republicans in the 1980s. For racist statements.
They say he was too racist. We talked about this last week on the show.
Yeah.
That even the federal government at that time, who was extremely conservative, said, you're a little too extreme for us.
Yeah. Yeah,
he could
be a member of a cabinet and be in charge of one of the largest sectors of the U.S. federal system, mm-hmm. and that's why I keep talking about one of the biggest things that nobody is mentioning in relation to this Trump election is that this is going to be one of the first times in history that the federal government is not going to be something that people, the masses, can look to for any type of help,
some kind of buffer at least.
Yeah, exactly. Some type of buffer, some type of safety net.
Yeah.
Bob Pelesny is crashing the show.
Okay.
Well, long-time listeners will remember Bob Pelesny, one of our
former... He's still part of the crew. He's still our technical advisor. He helps provide the union edge for us every week.
Yeah. Right. Well, anyway, he's texting and says that, something I'd forgotten, Betsy DeVos's brother is Eric Prince.
Blackwater.
That's right. That is right.
Blackwater, yes.
Yeah, she married into the family.
Oh, there. For those that don't know about Blackwater... it is the mercenary firm that murdered 17 Iraqi civilians at Nisar Square, Baghdad, in 2007. For people don't know Blackwater, and also what happened, that's the same group that was in Katrina as well.
Yes,
thanks
indeed.
For listening, yeah. Bob. Too.
Yes.
So that was also the mercenary for hire group that was going around shooting people in New Orleans during the Katrina.
Yes. And they've changed their names, I think, three times now. It went from Blackwater to, I think, Chi or something.
Yeah.
And now it's... Yeah, and now it's something else. I'm not sure. But yes, just like when Obama was elected.
Academy.
Just like when Obama was elected in 2008 and he promised all this hope and change, and then when we started seeing who his cabinet picks were, seeing the same old neoliberals, Robert Rubin, Lawrence Summers, I mean, all these people, we knew that was going to be a bunch of crap. Likewise, this is what happened to Donald Trump. He's not draining any swamp. He's basically, he's breeding worse snakes and reptiles than that, and fill in the swamp.
Yeah, and besides that, he's not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton.
No, they made a deal on that. They've
already been hurt too much.
Yeah,
listen, they're all friends.
This is what I say. They're all Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I don't care how vicious they got with each other verbally and public. They still belong to the same country club. Don't forget that, folks. These people, they put up a good dog and pony show, but they belong to the same country club.
Well, it's like George Carlin says. It is. Big club.
And you're not a member.
Right. But what's really, and it's got to be the American dream because you got to be asleep. Yeah, I believe.
One of the most interesting things, though, the developments that we've seen in relation to Trump's building of his cabinet is that he's actually gone from being that wild card that is unpredictable with late capital accumulation to being somebody who is actually getting closer to neoliberalism.
Yes.
I mean, if you actually look at a lot of the people he's picking, most of them are billionaires. Most of them are tied to Wall Street, and a lot of them were people who were in circles that supported Hillary Clinton. So what I think is happening is that, and that's what the internal problem is in his transition team, because you know there's a strife going on, is that Trump is leaning so much more towards this neoliberal policy that people internally don't like that. You know, so there's some problems going on. There's some conflict going on because he was acting one way as this wild card who was anti-establishment, and that, yeah, I'm a capitalist. I can do these things, and I'm not going to be a part of what they've been doing to the working class, blah, 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 blah. And then he's secretly actually going and doing these things that is supportive of neoliberal projects and pushing late capital into his next stage like Hillary Clinton was.
Yeah.
And we didn't see that coming. And that may be why you start seeing a lot of people going in, especially these liberals. Saying, let's give them a chance.
Yeah.
Because they are pro-capitalist too, and they have no problem with exploitation of workers or discrimination policies against people.
Well, these policies coming down the tube, but it's not going to hurt them. It's not going to affect their cushy, basically, they live on residuals.
Exactly.
You know, that's not going to affect anything.
It's the rentocracy.
The rentocracy, exactly. Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're going to keep on doing just what they're doing, and their civil rights aren't going to be violated. Their economic conditions aren't going to be violated. Their health care is not going to be affected. I mean, things are just going to go on as normal for them.
And the tax breaks are going to get a 35% tax cut.
Yes.
Meanwhile,
yeah.
They're going to do away with his plan. Does away with the head of the household and personal exemptions.
Yeah.
Which I was reading an article means that many single parent families. And other double parent families, I can't remember the exact things, will have a tax increase.
Exactly.
That, on the middle class level.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be devastating. And then one of the biggest things that you're also seeing in regards to the response to Trump is that you hear people, that there's a lot of individualism going on when you read social media, when you hear people speak. Nobody's talking about the masses of people that are going to be affected. I'm speaking squarely to the liberals and the petty bourgeois who were trying to make this into some abstract individual persecution of who they are, that Trump was elected, and that, you know, that we can't do anything anymore, we can't go to class anymore, we can't do this. But I haven't seen hardly anybody talking about the most oppressed groups that are going to suffer under what Trump is planning to do. We're talking about complete austerity, taking away material conditions from the communities in this country.
Meanwhile, Garrison Keillor can go bird watching for 8 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, did you read that article by him? Yeah.
Who's Garrison Keillor?
Lake Wobegon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, NPR guy.
Oh, I see.
Liberal.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You see, people like him, they can just go birdwatching for the next 8 years. That's basically what he said.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Yeah, and that's the reality we're faced with now. We have to understand how enclaves work. The people who are most oppressed and most dispossessed, we have to understand that we cannot rely on any other top-down groups, any other types of liberal groups, factions, to be there as a buffer zone. That's why the whole thing about self-determination is so important. We have to build our own communities and strengthen them and supply line, something that we're going to have to buffer ourselves with, because when the stuff really hits the fan, those same liberals saying give Trump a chance, they're not going to be there.
Yeah.
And plain and simple, because the very idea, because you remember the one thing that we saw when Obama started picking his cabinet, that's when you saw a lot of the Antichrist stuff come and all these huge attacks against him, left and right.
Yeah, here's what we're missing. We see people saying give Trump a chance. What we really need people saying is, if Trump actually does this, if he starts registering Muslims, I will be there, and I will get in that line. I will be on the front lines for you. That's the other half of that give Trump a chance that's missing.
Exactly.
Is if he fails, I will be on your side.
Exactly. And that's what we're not hearing. We're not hearing any type of real support for the people who are going to be most affected by this. We just see people. And again, I'm not disrespecting protests. I think protests are a major part of building social movements. We need to have them, but they're not grounded in any real objective to defy this fascist regime. Mm-hmm. There needs to be some objective in saying, no, we're going to do this if he does this. If he does this, we are going to do this. And
exactly.
That's not reactionary. It's, you're building a social movement. You're responding to a crisis in terms of survival.
Yes. And at first you defend, and then you go on the offensive.
Exactly.
Just like if he goes after Medicare, what people should do is basically fight for single payer even harder.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, and you see things happening, like at Standing Rock, a lot of the articles, reports I see talk about them having their medical services, basically, that they're doing themselves, having a kitchen, and so on and so forth, like it's actually somewhat of a functioning community.
Yeah,
exactly.
An alternative, a dual power, you might say, because they're also running their own law enforcement, is what I've read.
Okay,
we do have our own. We do have people who classify themselves, who call themselves security. Yeah, and there's people at every entrance to look at every car. And there's, as far as I can see, they're not searching cars, but they will ask you like, why are you here? And the eyes are being kept out. Yeah, the eyes are there.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no alcohol, drugs, or weapons allowed.
Yeah, I'll get on that, too. That is actually very true. Everywhere in camp it is emphasized, no weapons. Like, if we have to, we will search your car because there will be no weapons. On the front lines on Monday morning, the action had kept on through the night from Sunday night, and I went again in the morning, and there were still people on the bridge. There was a mass of us. At one point, the cop said, "We've identified a weapon in your crowd," and we got scared. You know, what are they about to do? Because they've said that we found this weapon, and you know, we're all putting our hands up, saying we have no weapons. Eventually, we get somebody to go over and talk to them. We find out, oh, it's some guy in all camo, and so we're like, all right, let's find this person. We find him, and it turned out to be the scope to a camera. So this no weapons thing is actually very real. This is It's a nonviolent camp, and whether you support violence or nonviolence, or you think that's a good tactic, as it stands right now, it's a extremely nonviolent environment, no weapons.
Well, I want to say something, too. I worked on a pipeline job between Decatur and Atwood, Illinois, all right? Mm-hmm. And it was this time of year in Illinois, and for us on that job, there was a lot of kind of waiting around for other people to get stuff on done. And we could go just sit in the trucks, and we had all our Carhartt heavy-duty clothes and everything like that, and it was still worth every bit of the wages to keep me out there in those conditions, much less what these people are going through. I mean, I could stay dry,
yeah,
you know, and people are getting wet. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
I can just imagine.
Yeah, and just to kind of go off, Dave, you brought up a good point about Medicare, because that's something that's kind of been swept under the rug because there's all this talk about recounts now, and that's been the most dominant news story outside of Castro's passing. But there was something interesting that was posted on his website. See, during his campaign, Trump declared that he had no plans to make substantial changes to Medicare. That was something he emphasized. But when you look at Trump's website now, right now, listeners, it says his administration will work to, quote, modernize Medicare and allow more flexibility for Medicaid. So
flexibility, so, like in bend over, is
that, you know, flexibility and like they talk about in the workplace too, where you don't have all those darn union rules.
Exactly. These are code.
Flexible is not a good word.
No,
it's not. And all union leaders and people who negotiate contracts, that's something you have to learn. That flexible and that
certain terms.
Yeah, I could do a whole show on that. Yeah. But these are code words signaling the readiness of the Trump administration to work with the Republican-controlled Congress to shift Medicare from a guaranteed government program to a plan with fixed government contributions programs are vouchers and the paved way for the program's privatization and dismantlement. We have to understand this, and it's been clear the Republican-controlled Congress have stated clearly that they want to dismantle Medicare.
Yes.
That's their major goal. That's their end goal.
Yes. So, just like, again, I have to go back to the example of Obama's first year in office. He appointed the Simpson-Bowles Committee to basically do the same thing with Social Security and Medicare.
Cat Food Committee.
Yeah. Yep. And basically wanted to work with Republicans on this and everything.
Yeah.
And what happened was a lot of organizations out there, in particular the Committee to Defend and Secure Medicare and Social Security, they, instead of, I mean, basically they went on defensive at first, but then they went on all-out offensive. And after about a year or so of struggle, they not only were able to stop any cuts from happening, other than the chain CPI, which messed a little bit with the cost of living, but they were actually able to expand Social Security. And that's what we need to do with everything here. Everything they come at us, we got to come back at them super hard and go on the offensive, not hunker down and be too defensive for too long, other than just to protect our initial assault. We got to go on the offensive.
Well, here's one way to go on the offensive. Every person that you can talk to, tell them about the $118,500 a year cap on social on the payroll tax.
Yes.
And explain to them that's why people in suits on TV keep telling us that Social Security is going to hell in a handbasket. I don't know why it's always in a handbasket. Because and all they have to do is raise that cap. But those suits are making over $118,500 a year, and so they don't want to pay any more. And that's, they're not paying their fair share. I mean, that's worse than it's a flat tax with a cap. That is incredibly regressive.
Yeah, and all the Western European countries, there is no cap. And that basically, the more you earn, the more the higher percentage you pay in to your general tax and income. I'm going to say it's your tax rate, and that goes into fund the Social Security, which is the most people. That's all they have in Western Europe because it supplies 90% of their net pay of what they earn when they were working.
Yeah, I mean, but
they retire.
Yeah, see, that is one of the problems with the United States is Social Security never turned into a portable pension. And that's what people really need to realize too about this health care is that what both of those things do is tie you to whatever job you've got right now. And it's a much bigger risk for an American to change jobs or for Americans to start a business.
Yes,
exactly.
I mean, one of the major reason that I still work pretty much part time as a laborer is just basically to keep up health insurance. I've been semi-retired all my life. I might as well keep on going.
And that's why we need Medicare for All, because that would free people up to be able to not stay in a crappy job they don't like because the healthcare.
And then if you're starting a business,
not to mention cheaper and better,
and you're going to need to hire people, then you're going to have to screw with that yourself.
Yes.
Whereas you can hire people that are already insured.
Yeah, well, because everybody would be insured.
Yeah, or even beyond starting a business, maybe even setting up your own temporary autonomous zone. Get it so you can feed yourself.
Good point. Sure,
you start growing some food, dig some compost toilets.
That's a good point, Eric, because see, this is what their objective is. They want to disempower us, enslave us, and basically push our standard of living down so low that we're willing to fight over a $2 an hour job to stay alive.
I mean, and then the thing that people aren't really looking at too is that where has Paul Ryan been in all of this? Because he's the key player here. Ryan's plan, and this is what Trump is going with now since they've had their meeting. Ryan's plan is that the government would give those in traditional Medicare a fixed amount to buy insurance. Right, this amount would be tracked to the country's overall growth rate or another index plus a percentage increase, but it would not keep pace with rising health care costs. Seniors would eventually pay a larger share of costs while government costs would shrink. In an earlier version proposed by Ryan, cost sharing, where the government currently pays roughly 70% of Medicare costs and beneficiaries pay 30%, would flip, leaving seniors responsible for 70% of costs and the government only 30%.
Wait until most Trump supporters have voted for him find out about this.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's the thing that we have to recognize, and you mentioned this earlier, is that working Republicans, Obama wanted to work with people. We have to get rid of this disillusionment that if somebody does not hold our interests, that we can work with them. That is the very Just contradiction of power.
Yeah, it's like asking a fossil fuel company saying, "I'm committed to the environment."
Oh yeah,
exactly. It's
absurd.
Exactly. You show me a capitalist that's involved in the environment, I'll show you a green sky. It doesn't exist.
Yeah,
and then just the same thing where the federal government under the current system that we serve, serving the interests of the people, it doesn't exist because they have two separate interests that they hold, and we have just like employer and employee. We have to understand that's the whole purpose of the union movement being created, is that they understood that without the interests of the workers in the employer's mind, they will continuously be exploited. And for some reason, we've lost that along the way, and I blame the liberals. I really believe the liberals hold this kind of shadow position where they pretend to be for the people, but they're spending so much time working with the pro-capitalist agenda.
Okay, let's see what happens here. All right. Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Okay, folks, for some reason, WRFU, you're on the air. Hi, Mark. I'm glad you called in and everything. I'm sorry to tell you this. We're kind of talking on the air right now, but we've been having a problem with our phone line here. We can't get the phone rings, but we can't get it transferred to the board. So I don't know what this is going to – I guess, you know, you can kind of – I'm not sure if listeners can hear us now or not, but I just was compelled to pick up the phone since you were calling in. But I guess we could just go real quick. I mean, I know you wanted to talk about a lot of things, but primarily it was about the upcoming labor campaign for single-payer conference coming up in New York City in January. Could you just mention some of those facts to me real quick?
Create some real opportunities for us to reconstruct the movement based on what we want rather than just circling the wagons around a flawed Affordable Care Act, and that I think that Medicare for All is a real powerful framing principle to move things forward, and that these were the kind of issues that we were going to struggle with when we get together in January. It's January 13th to 15th in New York City. And people can find out, can register by going to our website, laborforsinglepayer.org.
Okay, and you know, we were just talking before you called in about it looks like the new Trump administration, one of their top priorities, one of their first offenses is going after Medicare. And we were kind of the opinion that this would be a time to definitely to go on the offensive, to push for single payer, organize people and push for it like we've never pushed for it before, because it seemed like this is a strategy that worked back a couple years ago when Obama appointed the Bowles-Simpson Committee and tried to go after Social Security with the help of the Republicans.
I think that's exactly the approach that we want to take on this issue. The Social Security organizers flipped the agenda a few years back when they were talking about cutting back and privatizing Social Security. They changed the whole debate into expanding Social Security. And we need to do the same thing on the Medicare. I think this is really going to be the Achilles heel of the Trump healthcare policy. To try to turn Medicare into a voucher program will cause a great uproar, even among many people who supported Trump's candidacy. And, I think we can easily talk to the American people about expanding Medicare. What if we moved it down to age 62 as a first step, or age 57, and begun to move the eligibility age downward rather than think about moving it upwards and not paying for the full cost and making people on the hook for any additional charges. There's a whole lot we can do with that. And I think we're going to emerge from this this really horrible and difficult moment, I think we'll emerge stronger and more committed than ever to healthcare justice.
Okay, and if people wanted to find out more about the Labor Campaign for Single Payer Conference in New York City in January, where could they go to find out more information on that?
They can go to laborforsinglepayer.org, laborforsinglepayer.org.
Okay, Mark, thanks for calling in. Sorry about the technical difficulties, but we were able to do this kind of in a little crude manner with just holding the phone up the microphone. So thanks for calling in, and we'll be...
When you got your technical problem solved, we could talk about this in a little more detail.
Love to do that. Take care.
Okay,
that was Mark Dudzik of the Labor Campaign for Single Payer. We're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WRFU 104.5 FM, Radio Free Urbana. And we'll be right back. Okay, we're back, you're listening to the World Labor Hour, and this is on WRFU 104.5 FM, broadcasting from downtown Urbana, Illinois. And anyway, I guess Gus had a little story here about a recent death of a notable world leader. Gus?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking. It came surprise to everybody yesterday when Raul Castro announced that his brother Fidel Castro passed away yesterday. Castro has a very interesting, legacy that a lot of people don't really know much about. Of course, you know, you're going to have I know everybody's seen by now the video footage some of the Cubans in Miami celebrating the death. They had a parade, I think, last night and this morning, you know, but I'll talk about, because we know those were Batista supporters,
right,
that came over, and we know what happened with that. And I'll go into detail about that in a minute. But one of the things that we have to understand about Castro and his ideas of communism is that there are things that we can take away as being extremely successful. His ideas of education, his ideas of in terms of medical advancement, etc., and also his understandings of racial oppression in America. So there are some very powerful things you could take from them. But on the flip side, there are some issues, particularly for those of us who are Marxists, in terms of his dictatorship, very undemocratic ways of leading, his attack on certain groups of people, particularly homosexuals, etc. So I mean, so there are things that we have to understand about Castro, that there are things we appreciate, and particularly his revolutionary philosophy and fervor. But also there are issues with the way he did things. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do an analysis of his life.
Okay.
And I'll try to keep it brief because there's so much I can do on it. And it's going to be, so what I want to do is this week, we're going to do an analysis of Castro's life. And then next week, we're going to talk about when Raul takes over Cuba and the difference.
As far as speculation?
Yeah, no, in terms of what happened with the political economy.
Oh, as far as what happened when he actually, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, because that's a very big difference in what happened with Castro and when Fidel stepped down in 2008.
Okay.
What Raul has been doing, because if those don't know, Cuba has actually been letting in foreign capitalists to come in. There have been different massive layoffs in the past 8 years since Raul took over, and so that they've been leaning more so towards becoming investors and bringing in these corporations into Cuba that has really been hurting a lot of the things that's been happening there. So, but in terms of Fidel, when you start back and look at Fidel, He was the illegitimate son of a successful Creole sugar plantation owner, and he was born in 1926 in Cuba. He always had this personality of rebelliousness. This is one of the things I appreciate about Castro the most, because he reminds me of me when I was younger. And I had a very big problem with authority, especially growing up in the Southern Christian South that I grew up in. You know, that was not a good thing to have, because when you question authority, you're supposed to just listen and say yes, sir, or yes, ma'am. But, you know, I always had issues with that. So I really kind of understand where Castro was coming from. He was always questioning things. He was very rebellious and always getting into different types of trouble. And then at age 13, he engaged in his first major organized protest, and that he helped to organize a strike of sugar workers on his father's plantation.
On his father's plantation.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Oh,
wow.
So
13?
Yeah, 13 years old. So both his parents were illiterate. But they were determined that their children should receive a good education. They emphasized that. It was big in Fidel's upbringing. And he was sent to a Jesuit boarding school. Although he disliked the discipline at the school, and that's where he got into a lot of trouble, he soon showed that he was extremely intelligent. He excelled in a lot of his academics. Except for history, though, he really disliked a lot of the other subjects, and he really focused more so on sports. And he became this huge athlete. He was good at running, soccer, baseball.
Oh, yeah, he's almost. But didn't he come over to become a pro baseball player or something at one point? Or is that a myth?
I think that was a myth. I haven't seen that in any stories I've read, but I know that he was an amazing player, though. So he may have, and that's just not something I haven't seen, but it's possible. But in 1944, he was awarded the prize of Cuba's best all-around school athlete in the entire country. So he was serious with it. So after he finished his education, he went into become a lawyer, practiced law in Havana. As he tended to take the cases of poor people who could not afford to pay him, he was always short on money, right? So his experience as a lawyer made him extremely critical of the great inequalities in wealth. So one of the biggest things that people don't understand is that, yes, he may have come from not necessarily a super privileged background, but he came from a somewhat privileged background. But he had the experiences of working with the working classes and the poor people. And he already had an organizational mindset and philosophy when he was younger. So working with poor people in Havana really kind of helped shape his philosophy of revolution. And this really understanding of these inequalities are unfair. Is there something I can really do about it? So that's important to recognize. So he began to recognize that a lot of the issues going on in Cuba were tied directly to the United States. And he took that as saying, like, okay, he starts reading more about imperialism and understanding capital, et cetera. You know, and that becomes a major part of his focus moving forward. So in 1947, he joins the Cuban People's Party. And he was attracted to this new party's campaign against corruption, injustice, poverty, unemployment, and low wages. The Cuban People's Party accused government ministers of taking bribes and running the country for the benefit of the United States corporations that had factories and offices throughout the entire country. So, and in 1952, Castro became a candidate for Congress for the Cuban People's Party. And he was a superb public speaker. And that's one of the things, if you get a chance, listeners, to actually watch his speeches, that's one of the things that people just literally were in awe of. You don't hear that about Castro that much, is that, when, especially when he gives his four-hour speech, history will, history will...
absolve us?
Yeah, history absolve me. Is that a,
actually, when we were younger, more like in the 60s, there would be sort of cultural references to such long speeches by Castro.
Exactly.
You know, but that, you know, that kind of went out maybe in the 70s or
you don't
well, the Woody Allen movie Bananas.
Oh yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Oh, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost like it was written about Fidel Castro in some sense.
Really?
Yeah. Let's see. Woody Allen goes to some Caribbean island or somewhere. I can't. It's been a long time since I'd seen it. And he looks just like the guy who runs it, and he gets put into power. And it's really, it's so analogous to what happened with Cuba.
Okay. Yeah, that's but that's something that you just don't really hear much about, is when you talk about Castro, is that his ability, his public speaking skill. He had the ability to draw people towards him. You know, he was always taking crowds with him. And that was something that his opposition noticed early. And so he was definitely targeted when he started getting more power in the Cuban People's Party. And that becomes important because the Cuban People's Party was expected to win the election in 1952, but of course, the Batista, General Batista, which is a part of the armed forces, took control of the country then. And so a lot of people were saying that if Batista didn't do that, then the Cuban People's Party would have easily won that election, and Castro was going to be, you know, ascending to power at that point. So Castro came to the conclusion that, and this is important to recognize because we have to understand how Marxism works in terms of it being scientific, and that he engaged the state of nationalism in trying to engage in electoral politics as a means to solve the problems of inequality in the country. He recognized that this is not going to work, that I can't go through electoral politics to actually win. And so he develops a philosophy of revolution of overtaking the state and actually usurping power from those in power. He understood that there was no way that I could negotiate my way into power, that you have to take it.
Because I take it with the dictatorship of Batista that they probably still had a parliament, but it really didn't mean anything.
Exactly. It was meaningless. Yeah. As long as Batista held the, used the military and the armed forces at his beckoning, you know, he was able to do all sorts of things. Plus, he had the United States support. And that's incredibly important to understand, especially when the Cuban Revolution starts.
Yeah.
So,
and not to mention that Batista was a brutal dictator.
Oh yeah.
Torture, murder.
Well,
corruption, I mean, was, beyond belief. Yeah. You know.
The Cuba was owned by the mafia.
Exactly.
Basically, yeah. You know, there's a famous scene in
Godfather.
The Godfather, yep. Where they're cutting up the Cuban cake.
Well, they didn't really own Cuba, but they had a ministry. Minister of Tourism, I think, was one of those gangs.
Well, you know, they had a large stake in a lot of what happened in Cuba, and that's one of the things that Castro does away with immediately when he takes power. Is he tells all the mafia people, you have this much time to leave the island, or I'm going to remove you in a different way.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons the mob was involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
They lost a lot of money after the Cuban Revolution, as far as the casinos no longer operating. Yeah,
it was huge.
And Kennedy didn't send the air cover to for the Bay of Pigs.
Exactly,
which was a very aptly named operation.
So the first attempt to take power was in 1953, and Castro, with an armed group of 123 men and women, attacked the Moncada Army Barracks. The plan to overthrow Batista ended in really a disaster, and although only 8 were killed in the fighting, another 80 were murdered by the army after they were captured. Castro, and this is interesting, this goes into this whole thing about what happened if one thing changed in history, because Castro was very lucky that the lieutenant who arrested him ignored orders to have him executed and instead delivered him to the nearest civilian prison. So most of the lieutenants, when they arrested the group, they were told to execute on sight. And Castro found one of the few who ignored it and took him, or otherwise who knows what history would be like right now.
Right.
So that's
Cuba would be like Haiti.
Exactly. So that's a very interesting story. Yeah. Like, you know, when you come across that. So, he's taken to a civilian prison. He also, he almost comes close to death in prison as well. Captain Pelletier was instructed to put poison in Castro's food, but he refused and instead revealed his orders to the Cuban people. So Pelletier was court-martialed, but concerned about world opinion, Batista decided not to have Castro killed. So that's what gets really interesting.
I never knew that story. That explains a lot, because I was always, it seemed like Castro lived quite a charmed life in a lot of ways. It's like, and that was one of the first things, is how did he ever survive that Makata Barracks reign, you know, basically repression after the fact, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was clear that they told him that you're going to have to, that they tried to poison him, and then, you know, he gets so much support from the people when he goes on trial. You know, and Batista's like, yeah, I can't, I'm not going to have you killed. I'm going to put you on trial so I can make myself look better to the people. But that's the wrong move, because he gives the 4-hour speech of history will absolve me. And that literally just sends shockwaves through the streets of Cuba, because he takes it as a speech. And if you listeners, you haven't seen the speech, it is very long, but you should read a lot of it, because it's basically a declaration of the problems of Cuba because of what capital does to the people. I mean, he just goes down the line, and it's just amazing the way he does it. He uses other parts of freedom speeches from Thomas Paine, from John Locke. He looks at the Declaration of Rights of Man. He looks at Haitian Revolution stuff. So he's bringing in all these different liberation ideologies to talk about why revolution is important. And by that point, there was too much support for him. So Batista does not execute him. He gives him a 15-year sentence, and Castro only takes 2 years of the sentence and then leaves. Then goes to Mexico, and that's where he meets Che Guevara and others, and they formed the July 26 movement. So that becomes a major aspect. And my thing froze.
Oh, okay.
With my talk.
Now, I'm 60 years old, so I was like, when was this?
Maybe three, when the Cuban Revolution happened.
But I always had this, even as a child, I just always really liked Fidel Castro. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was the beard or the military uniform or the cigar or what, but he just seemed like this really cool guy that I just really liked him.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have understood any of his speeches.
There was a movie that came out in Spanish with English subtitles called Che. They've got an actor who portrays Fidel Castro in there. Uncanny resemblance to him, exactly. Both in his appearance and also the way he talks. I mean, it's just that actor was just, I mean, unbelievable.
So, yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen that movie, it's a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
The second
part's really depressing. The first part is really inspiring.
Yeah, but it's a very good depiction of both Fidel and Che. I mean, it's like, literally, like, I'm very hard on historical depictions in film, particularly Hollywood film.
Yeah.
But this was Steven Soderbergh, and what he did was, it was an independent made film. He used a lot of his own money and was funded through other Marxist groups to help him make it so that he could keep it out of that Hollywood, you know, mess. Yeah. And so it's a very accurate depiction, and you're right, the second part is incredibly depressing, but you really should see both parts.
Yeah.
Now, I got the thing pulled up on my phone now, because I don't know, the internet here is frozen, my thing, for my talk. But so after building up a stock of guns and ammunition, Castro, Che, Juan Amadia, and the rest of the July 26 movement, and they chose that date because that's the date that Castro had attacked Moncada Barracks, their plan was to set up their base in the Sierra Maestra Mountains. On the way to the mountains, they were attacked by government troops, so somebody already knew what was happening there. By the time they reached the Sierra Maestra, there were only 16 men left with 12 weapons between them. That's it. For the next few months, Castro's guerrilla army raided isolated army garrisons and were gradually able to build up their stock of weapons. Very important. So when the guerrillas took control of territories, they redistributed the land amongst the peasants. Now, this is important. In return, the peasants helped the guerrillas against Batista's soldiers. A lot of people don't understand, how did Castro's guerrilla army take care of Batista, supplied by the United States? This is why, because he was able to garner so much popular support amongst the peasant group that they were so helpful in getting him weapons and support, food, supplies, etc. That's how he was able to outlast and beat Batista. In some cases, the peasants also joined Castro's army, as did students from the cities and occasionally Catholic priests. A lot of people don't know that there was a major student movement that was pro-Castro during the Cuban Revolution. In an effort to find out information about Castro's army, people were pulled in for questioning by Batista. Many innocent people, including children, were tortured. Suspects were publicly executed and then left hanging in the streets for several days as a warning to anybody who was considered joining Castro. The behavior of Batista's forces increased support for the guerrillas. In 1958, 45 organizations signed an open letter supporting July 26 movement. National bodies representing lawyers, architects, dentists, accountants, and social workers were among those who signed. Castro, who had originally relied on the support of the poor, was now gaining the backing of the influential middle classes. Now, this is interesting when you think about a Marxist theory of revolution, and that you have the middle class, you have the petty bourgeoisie, and you have some members of the bourgeoisie who do own their own, who do own the means of production, joining a revolutionary movement. Now that comes into question, what's going to happen when Castro takes power and forms his own idea of socialism? Because we're going to talk about that. That's important to recognize, because the question that we have to ask is, if we do form a revolutionary movement built on working class opposition, if the petty bourgeoisie joins along, who have separate interests than the working class, and this is what C.L.R. James was talking about in the Black Jacobins, is that going to lead to a vanguard break from the masses or the movement? And that's really going to be the issue that happens in Cuba, that's going to happen in other parts of the world too that have communist revolutions as well. And, you know, I'll talk about that later. So Batista responded by sending troops to Sierra Maestra. He now had 10,000 men hunting for Castro and his 300-strong army. Although outnumbered,
300.
Yeah, is it 300? Although outnumbered, Castro's guerrillas were able to inflict defeat after defeat on the government's troops because of the support of the peasants. And also you had money coming in from the petty bourgeoisie, the middle classes at the time. In the summer of 1958, over 1,000 of Batista's soldiers were killed or wounded, and many more were captured. And this is all shown greatly in the movie we talked about, Jay. Unlike Batista's soldiers, Castro's troops had developed a reputation for behaving well towards prisoners. And this is something that the U.S. sent a lot of bad propaganda out about Castro and how he treated prisoners. And that was completely wrong when you actually talked to many of the prisoners at that time. They said that Castro treated them extremely well. And this encouraged Batista's troops to actually surrender. And some of them even joined the Castro guerrilla groups. So again, when you actually read the narratives of the people that were there versus U.S. propaganda against Castro, you know, and you see a lot of the stories coming out today from these corporate media sites about Castro, and then Trump tweeted out the brutal dictator is gone and all this stuff.
Well, even Bernie Sanders called him a dictator.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, and then, you know, so this is important. So, and the U.S. gave Batista planes, ships, tanks, but with the advantage of using the latest technology such as napalm, they failed to even beat the guerrillas. And this is just like the Haitian Revolution, where the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, and the French Empire all tried to beat the slaves in Haiti, and they all failed.
With the best technology at the time.
The best technology at the time.
I need to correct myself. Bernie Sanders said
Hugo Chavez.
Hugo Chavez was a dictator, which is even worse.
Oh, yeah. That's so the workers came out on strike, and the military were forced to accept the people's desire for change. And after a while, Castro marched through Havana after Batista fell January 9th, 1959, and became the new leader.
This all happened within about a two-year period, right?
From
the time they landed on that beach and were ambushed and lost a bunch of their men, and they fled to the Sierra Maestra Mountains. And time they actually took, you know, basically won the revolution, that was like a 2 year period, right?
Well, about 3 years, 56 to early. Well, you're right, because at the beginning of 59, so that's 2 years.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that's just an incredible story.
Now, by the way, the movie that you've referred to, Shay, it's on Netflix.
Oh, good.
So if you have a Netflix subscription, you can watch it. Don't watch it right now, watch it after the show.
Yeah, watch after the show. Now, here's the thing. Now, here's where people are split on Castro, is what he did when he went into office
right.
versus is the revolution. So here's a clear, and this, I'm getting my sources from primary documents from the government for what he did when he went into office. So I'm going to be fair, mm-hmm. but also critical now. In the first 100 days in office, he passed a whole bunch of new laws that set up to serve the needs of the people. He did. Rents were cut by up to 50% for low wage earners. Property owned by Batista and his ministers was confiscated and redistributed to the peasantry. The telephone company was nationalized and the rates were reduced by 50%. And I already talked about land being redistributed. Separate facilities for blacks and whites were abolished. Now, this is important to recognize, and this is why many African Americans during the Civil Rights Movement and Black Power Movement went to Cuba, particularly Robert Williams, who was one of the first to advocate self-defense violence to protect yourself, a former member of the NAACP.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you got to say Castro was so supportive because whenever he went to the U.S., he always visited black communities. He always went to Harlem like that. Every time he came to the U.S., he had to go to Harlem and he walked around there. He funded anti-apartheid forces in South Africa and gave black political prisoners such as Assad Shakur refuge. And gave him a special place in the heart of the black community. So again, this is something that, you know, that's very important and why so many African Americans really love Castro. Of course, today with the Cold War crap that came out, you hear a lot of anti-Castro stuff, particularly from the petty bourgeoisie, black mm-hmm. middle class. But when you look at the black working class and activists and student groups, you always saw Castro shirts, Castro posters, quoting Castro, especially during the Black Power movement. That was important because of the stuff that he represented. Now, here's where things get dicey with Castro's rules. He has strong views on morality, and this is also depicted in the movie Che as well, that he considered alcohol, drugs, and gambling to be horrible things for people's morality, and it would lead to vice and bad things happening in society. So he got rid of those. Also,
well, he didn't abolish alcohol, though.
Well, he didn't abolish it, but he was very hard on in terms of laws,
mm-hmm.
prostitution as well. That was a big thing. He was a big morality defender. And one of the things he also accused of affecting morality was homosexuality, and he didn't admit it until years later that he did persecute homosexuals in Cuba. So that was something that he did, and he admitted it later. But it was a very bad thing in terms of going.
And you got to understand the context of the times. I mean, not to give him too much slack here, but
of course, yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Where in the world in 1959 was there really, you know, where homosexuals weren't persecuted to one degree or another?
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. But in terms of looking at it from a moral standpoint, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, the United States was full of laws, and
you could go to jail and even to mental institutions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, really, you're bad. Right. Thank you. That's a very good point, because that was, you know, especially now with Pence, you know, Mr. Homosexual Conversion Therapy, which is what they actually tried to do. They used to try to shock the homosexuality out of people, causing them to be brain dead in some instances. So I'm glad y'all brought that up. That is important.
Electroshock?
Yeah, they used to use electroshock.
Oh.
There was a show that came on a couple years ago, it still comes on, called American Horror Story.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the seasons was Asylum, and one of the ladies on there was a lesbian, and because she was a lesbian, they took her to the asylum, and they gave her shock therapy.
Okay, you talk about in the past.
Yeah, in the past. Yeah, okay, this was something that was happening in the past for a while.
Right, they do still try to do gay conversion right now, but I don't know if they're still shocking people.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but and it's more like a like when they get you back from a religious cult kind of thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
Thing. And deprogramming. Exactly. I think it's more like that. And it's illegal, and I think it's illegal maybe in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Or they're trying to pass a law to make it illegal.
For what?
For to have gay conversion therapy.
Oh, okay. Oh,
okay.
And this is done usually by like private clinics or something.
Exactly.
Right? Okay. Yeah.
Now this is
religious private clinics,
yeah,
usually.
Yeah, yeah.
Now here's the thing that we have to take as a model from Castro and what he did. He was very big on education. Education was his big piece. Before the revolution, 23.6% of the Cuban population were illiterate. In rural areas, over half the population could not read or write, and 61% of the children did not go to school. Castro asked young students in the cities to travel to the countryside and teach the people to read and write. And Cuba adopted the slogan, if you don't know, learn. I mean, I really wish we had that now. I'm telling you, if you know, teach. I mean, this is so important. These are things that we do not value in this country for other, I mean, for many reasons in terms of capital accumulation.
Yes. Education like healthcare, it's a luxury. You have to work for it.
Exactly.
It's not a human right. What a horrible idea.
Yeah, these simple ideas reminds me of Richard Wolff, and he's saying, well, we have all these empty factories sitting around with equipment in them and tools, and we got all these unemployed people over here. Somehow, could we get them together?
Yeah.
You know? It's like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so eventually free education is made available to all citizens, and illiteracy in Cuba became a thing of the past. I mean, this was a very huge push. And one of the biggest things now today is that you can get a PhD in Cuba for free. You can actually go down there and become a medical doctor for free, you know.
If you're from another country.
If you're from another country.
There's even, I know there's Americans that have gone
down
there.
Yeah, I know a few personally that have actually gone down there and actually gotten degrees for free in Cuba.
It reminds me of Grenada.
Oh.
The island that Reagan invaded.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of health care, another big thing that you never hear Cuba celebrated for or Castro celebrated for, the new Cuban government set up about the problem of health care. And before the revolution, Cuba had 6,000 doctors. Of these, 64% worked in Havana, where most of the rich people live, right? When Castro ordered that doctors had to be redistributed throughout the country, over half decided to leave Cuba. So again, when you see people celebrating and all this mess, it was in fact because they were going to lose profits. So those people going over in Miami and stuff and going off boats, most of them were white Cubans, and a lot of them were part of a profit system that they were upset that Castro was upsetting. So that's something that has to be taken into account. That's very important that people don't recognize. So so to replace them, Cuba built three new training schools for doctors. The death of young children from disease was a major problem in Cuba as well. Infant mortality was 60 per 1,000 live births in 1959, which is a lot. To help deal with this, Cuba introduced a free health service and started a massive inoculation program. By 1980, infant mortality had fallen to 15 per 1,000. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a huge drop that I don't think any other country has ever seen. This figure is now the best in the developing world and is in fact better than many areas of the United States to this day. It has been estimated that in his 7-year reign, Batista's regime had murdered over 20,000 Cubans. Those involved in the murders had not expected to lose power and had kept records, including photographs of the people they had tortured and murdered. So we know from primary sources that over 20,000 Cubans were murdered by Batista and his forces. Castro established public tribunals to try the people responsible, and only an estimated 600 people were executed. Although this pleased the relatives of the people murdered by Batista, these executions shocked world opinion. Now, this is incredibly important because one of the biggest parts of U.S. propaganda against Castro is that he went around just executing thousands of people, et cetera, et cetera. But the U.S. backed Batista. Not only did they torture and execute people, kept photographs, killed entire families.
Yeah.
So again, another.
In the tens of thousands. Under 1,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what Castro did was, I was expecting there to be more counter-revolutionaries. 600 is a very low number to deal with when you're trying to get rid of counter-revolutionaries.
Also, from what I've read about this is that these relatives of the dead, yeah. The torture and murdered victims, they demanded that they were like protesting,
yeah.
You know, that something, and that's how the whole tribunal was originally set up.
Exactly. Because
they didn't know for sure what they were going to do with these people. They set them on a plane or a boat to Miami or, you know, yeah. What.
So again, another example of propaganda being proven false, that Castro did not just go around executing everybody, that there was a tribunal set up, and he still, and still only 600 people initially were executed.
Who were tortured. and murderers for the government. Yes.
And then they were not tortured. They were strictly just executed.
Yes.
And some of them were counter-revolutionaries, which you have to deal with when you have a revolution. And people who don't understand that, it is what it is. So some of Castro's new laws went after the U.S. Now, this is when you start talking about the Bay of Pigs stuff. Much of the land given to the peasants was owned by U.S. corporations, and that's important to recognize. So also was the telephone company that was nationalized.
Yeah. Those were corporations were the Dulles brothers' old friends and employers, you know, the fruit companies and such.
That's right. Excellent.
And
that's
Sinclair Oil, I think, was real big.
Oh, yeah.
You remember Alan Dulles, the founder of the CIA.
That's right. And that's important to recognize. And,
probably the mastermind behind the murder of JFK.
Exactly. And a lot of people think that the U.S. just hated Castro because he came out as a Marxist. That he was,
and even that he didn't. You know, he went and tried to get right after the revolution, went and met with Eisenhower, Nixon actually. Tried to get some kind of normalized relations. And I mean, right after the meeting, the Eisenhower administration immediately started turning the screws on.
Yeah, because
of the land reform.
Exactly, that's the big thing that people don't recognize. Yeah.
Well, there was the threat of a successful non-capitalist society.
Yeah,
exactly.
And the thing is, here's what they got to realize, man. You keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, they really blew that. That was ridiculous.
Well, anyway, then that's when later, I mean, this is the thing, is Castro was pushed into the arms of the Soviet bloc.
Exactly. So the United States government responded by telling Castro they would no longer be willing to supply the technology and technicians to run the economy of Cuba. When this failed to change Castro's policies, they reduced their orders for Cuban sugar. Castro refused to be intimidated by the U.S., and he adopted an even more aggressive policy towards them. Now, this is where the fun starts. Mm-hmm. In the summer of 1960, Castro nationalized U.S. property worth $850 million. He also negotiated a deal whereby the Soviet Union and other communist countries in Eastern Europe agreed to purchase the sugar that the U.S. had refused to take. Now, this is what set the U.S. into huge, like, high blood pressure, everything.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, no. This guy has to go,
mm-hmm.
because they thought that they were going to crumble his economy by doing that. No. Castro had another plan. The Soviet Union also agreed to supply the weapons, technicians, and machinery denied to Cuba by the U.S. So Castro was playing a very smart game and creating a support system of oppressed groups. When the U.S. decided to strike, because Castro was smart. He knew that because he was a communist and because he redistributed the land and he dealt with all these things this way, that the U.S. was going to have to come after him, particularly after he got rid of Batista. So Eisenhower is in this situation. The more he attempted to punish Castro, the closer he became to the Soviet Union. So they're getting real buddy-buddy. His main fear was that Cuba could eventually become a Soviet military base.
And here's the thing is, Cuba could have been like Yugoslavia,
exactly.
To where it was a communist country, but it was neutral. It wasn't part of the Soviet bloc or any other military alliance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
well, I don't know. This is kind of getting off track, but what is it with Finland? Was Finland?
It was just neutral because of, well, there's some weird history there between, you know, it's between Sweden and Russia, and there was some, you know, Russia's invaded it and Sweden's invaded it. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's why it's.
I never really understood where their place was in that whole system.
So going into what Bill was getting at, mm-hmm. in a minute. In March of 1960, Eisenhower approved the first CIA plan to overthrow Castro, and this becomes the first of $1 billion that ends up being spent in trying to assassinate Fidel Castro.
And that was mid 1960s dollars. So
yeah,
we're talking probably, you know, tens of billions.
Now, here's the budget. The plan involved a budget of $13 million to train a paramilitary force outside of Cuba for guerrilla action. That's the actual, that's actually released from FOIA documents.
How at this time would you say the American government is purporting or justifying itself to the American people for this kind of operation? Go take out Castro.
Because what they're doing is they're claiming that their propaganda at that time was that because Castro got closer to the Soviet Union, and then of course with the space race, this was after Sputnik, this was after the arms race had really heated up, and of course everybody's doing these bomb drills and the Soviet Union's going to bomb
and cover.
Exactly. So that's what they're doing. They're painting this portrait of Cuba and the Soviet Union being this evil entity, and since they're so close to us, they can't kill us at any point.
Well, here's how bad it is. Have you ever heard of Operation Northwoods?
Yep.
Yeah, they were. That was actually an operation that the Pentagon had seriously planned and would have carried out if it wasn't for JFK, and that is that they were going to take an airliner, fill it full of people that were like CIA related, and call them students, fly them out over the Caribbean and shoot them down, and blame it on Castro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All that stuff and all this stuff
even,
is, and
also, I mean, they were going to fake it being shot down, that it was going to land somewhere else.
And there was also even plans in that Operation Outrage to have actual terrorist attack. I mean, basically, the CIA planting bombs in cities like Miami and other large cities to cause death and destruction.
And this is not conspiracy theory stuff.
This stuff has all been
documents have been released. This was part of the plan of that initial $13 million that's going to balloon over the 60s. Now, an estimated 400 CIA officers were employed full-time to carry out the one that everybody knows about, Operation Mongoose.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Edward Lansdale, project leader, blah, 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 blah. Now, this is important. Sidney Gottlieb of the CIA Technical Services Division was asked to come up with proposals that would undermine Castro's popularity with the Cuban people. So not only were they going to try to assassinate him, they had to find a way to develop a counter-revolutionary strategy for the people to overthrow him. Plans included, listen to this, listeners, They came up with plans that included a scheme to spray a television studio in which he was about to appear with a hallucinogenic drug and contaminating his shoes with thallium, which they believe would cause the hair in his beard to fall out.
Oh, yeah, the beard thing. That's always a good one.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that this is all well-known documents. So.
And the hallucinogenic thing was MK Ultra, right?
Yeah, and there's also a woman who claims that she worked as some kind of research assistant in New Orleans around 1963, and that CIA-related scientists were working on weaponizing cancer at that time.
Yep, that's
for
true.
Use of Castro. And a lot of these, like Lansdale, that name just, bam, lit my, you know, a lot of these people were not just involved with the JFK assassination and anti-Cuban stuff. They're also involved in getting rid of Richard Nixon through Watergate.
Exactly.
You know, like a lot of those low-level plumbers.
Guess who's
still CIA?
So guess who the CIA goes to next when all these plans are being rejected? They knock on the door of the mafia.
Yeah.
So in September 1960, Richard Bazell and Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA at the time, initiated talks with two leading figures of the mafia, Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana.
Of Chicago.
Oh, yeah, they used to run the Laborers Union.
Yep, they ran the Laborers Union.
Yep.
And then they also talked to Meyer Lansky, who was one of the biggest mob figures at the time that ran with Lucky Luciano and the commission group that controlled Chicago, etc. So, again, this is becoming a huge thing. So Robert Mayhew, a veteran of CIA counterespionage activities, was instructed to offer the mafia $150,000 to kill Castro. The advantage of employing the mafia for this work is that it provided CIA with a credible cover story. That's important. So the FBI had to be brought into this plan as part of the deal involved protection against investigation against the mafia in the U.S. So, like I said, y'all, none of this is conspiracy stuff. People think that, oh, my God, this is Oliver Stone. No, these are documents that have shown that this really occurred. In 1968, Eisenhower retired, and the problem of dealing with Castro was passed to Kennedy. The new president continued with Eisenhower's policy of trying to assassinate Castro, and this became known as Operation Freedom. And then was placed under control of Robert Kennedy.
And those same people were the people who assassinated JFK.
Yep.
James Files, who is currently living in Chicago on parole, claims that John Roselli was the initial trigger man, and that he was and Roselli was positioned where the shot came from the back.
Yeah.
That first shot. And then, Files was the guy on the grassy knoll where that shot comes in that completely blows his brains apart. Mm-hmm. And he used specially made mercury-filled bullets to create that effect.
Exactly. Now what has all this propaganda in the country done to Castro at the time and the Cuban people? In the 3 years that followed the revolution, 250,000 Cubans out of the 6 million left the country. But guess who these people were? The upper classes who were financially worse off because they were losing profits in the 3 years since Castro redistributed wealth and land. So again, for those listening, the people who were fleeing Cuba were not these people who were just solely persecuted by Castro being a dictator murdering people. These were business leaders who were losing their profits since he made the country more fair and equal to the working people. And that's the real narrative that needs to become dominant at this point.
Well, I'm sure that they took a lot of capital with them in forms
of it,
you know, and that really drains the country.
And yeah, and that's another thing that people don't talk about is that a lot of those doctors did. They took a lot of their stuff with them. A lot of the business owners did take their licenses, et cetera, with them as well.
Well, I would like to look at this in terms of also Venezuela right now, where there's basically been a capital strike go on for, I think, at least a year since Chavez has died. They keep talking about, and it gets interpreted just as bad in the American media as Cuba was. Oh, it's Maduro's fault. No, it's not Maduro's fault. It's because the distributors of food won't distribute the food because they want the people to hurt and kick Maduro out of office.
Yeah. And there's also historical comparisons with this, with Chile too, in the early 1970s.
Right, make the economy scream.
Yeah.
All right.
So we're getting close.
Oh yeah, I know. So now the Bay of Pigs, of course, and this is where, and again, this is from primary sources because there's so many conflicting stories about this.
Yeah.
So Kennedy replaced Eisenhower, and he was told about the CIA plan to invade Cuba. So this was already in effect when he becomes president. Kennedy had doubts about the venture, but he was afraid to be seen as soft on communism if he refused permission for it to go ahead. Because Kennedy wanted to stop it. He wanted to stop the Bay of Pigs invasion because he wasn't prepped in time. Nixon knew everything about it. He was prepped. And he was like, no, we got to do this. I got this. Don't worry about it. But Kennedy was like, That's important to recognize because what's going to happen? Kennedy's advisors convinced him that Castro was an unpopular leader, and this is Nixon, that Castro was an unpopular leader, and that once the invasion started, the Cuban people would support CIA-trained forces. There would be this huge liberation parade on the island, et cetera, et cetera. So April 14, 1961, the B-26 planes bombed Cuba's airfields. After the raids, Cuba was left with only 8 planes and 7 pilots. That's how much damage they did. 2 days later, 5 merchant ships carrying 1,400 Cuban exiles arrived at the Bay of Pigs. The attack was a complete and utter failure. 2 of the ships were sunk, including the ship that was carrying most of the supplies. 2 of the planes that were attempting to give air cover were also shot down. Within 72 hours, all the invading troops had been killed, wounded, or had surrendered. At the beginning of September 1962, U-2 spy planes discovered that the Soviet Union was building surface-to-air missile launch sites.
Oh, man, I remember
that. So this is 1 year after the Bay of Pigs invasion.
The very next year, and I'll get into why that's important in a second. There was also an increase in the number of Soviet ships arriving in Cuba, which the United States government feared were carrying new supplies of weapons. Now, this was to your point earlier about when you see the full-scale propaganda of anti-Cuban sentiment in the U.S. was because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's when everything turned, and that's when they really ramped up all these propaganda fake stories about Castro doing all these horrible things and doing it in conjunction with the Soviet Union.
Well, I was really scared.
Yeah.
I was 6 years old.
Yeah, my mother told me the same thing. Like, she told me about the drills that they had to do and that they literally were just on pins and needles wondering would nuclear war start. And so she remembers that, like, they were just...
I was 5, but I don't remember that. My first political memory is the next year of the Kennedy assassination.
See, now, I don't remember. That's not the one for me. My friend of mine who went to a Catholic school was telling me about it, and he said they stopped and they prayed.
Yeah. Wow. During the Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay.
No, after the Kennedy assassination.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, so we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we almost had a nuclear war.
It was almost a nuclear war, and of course, you know, to make a long story short, there was a bunch of backdoor negotiations, and of course, it went away. But the big emphasis about this, and not trying to make this more U.S. centric, is that you started seeing people like Nixon trying to go talk to China. Whereas in the Soviet Union and Cuba were still kind of getting tighter, and that propaganda was being pushed throughout the country. The Cold War heightened to levels we've never seen before. And Castro, that's when you really start seeing this anti-Castro sentiment now. Like the people, particularly students who were supporting Castro, reading his works and giving speeches about him, et cetera, were now starting to be booed and persecuted, et cetera. And a lot of that had to do with what was happening with the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that's important to recognize. So following the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, after it's over, Castro remained dependent on the support of the Soviet Union. Khrushchev was ousted from power on October 1964, but his successors provided aid to the Cuban government. However, after the fall of communism in the Soviet Union, this economic help came to an end.
Late 1989.
Yeah, and then next week we're gonna do part two of this when we talk about what happens to Cuba's economy after Castro leaves his post as president.
This is quite lengthy, you know, and I'll tell you though, this is important to realize to better understand the evil empire that we're dealing with, past, present, future,
and also to understand who Fidel Castro was as a person, where his revolutionary fervor, where his understanding of class injustice and class warfare came from, and how he developed, and like I said, we're really gonna focus a lot on the political economy of Cuba before and after Castro leaves, and see what really, in terms of unemployment, in terms of jobs, in terms of privatization, and dealing with these foreign invasions, etc. Because today was more so about Castro himself, to celebrate his life and to have critiques, because he did have problems. He did go after ministers that spoke out against him, and did imprison people for life if they spoke out against him on the island. And again, a big thing for me, my biggest issue with Castro was being president for life. You know, my big thing is that you have to have democratic elections. You know, in turn, if you're going to have a socialist government, you know, so.
Well, I like looking at it through. This is sort of like the maturation of the deep state.
Exactly.
Inside the United States, had a lot to do with Castro.
Yeah,
the Dulles brothers, all those people that are popping up and things later on, like the Watergate, and even there's some people that draw a line straight through 9/11.
Yeah, I mean that's
That's the thing, is that there's a trend now for basically, you know, the ruling class to try to say anything that you mention that involves any kind of collusion or, you know, anything like that, and yes, even conspiracy amongst people in the ruling class, that's supposedly your conspiracy theorist, that you basically, they never talk to each other, supposedly, you know. They've never colluded, you know, to, you know, do things that were, you know, even illegal. But, you know, as Gus said, a lot of the stuff is, I mean, let's put it this way, you should never just prop out, you know, weird conspiracy theories. However, there are a lot of historical conspiracy facts. I mean, in history, going back,
the documents are available.
Yeah,
I've just seen something here where I'm a little bit disappointed, and I hope this is a misquote or something.
Yeah,
but it has to do with the Green Party trying to get recounts.
Oh yes, I was going to talk about that.
Okay, well, this is from Business Insider. Officials in the Obama administration threw cold water on the effort to recount votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania on Friday. The effort was spearheaded by Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who echoed arguments that Russia may have hacked U.S. voting machines.
Oh, here
now,
we go.
No, it's the Republicans. Reds that did it, not the Russians.
I didn't hear her make the... She said
Well,
that.
That's what this article is saying. I don't know. I
can't believe she'd say that, but...
There's already... Many people trash her a lot of times over vaccination, which she has a reason
more
to view.
More misinformation. Anyway, I wanted to get into that because there's a great article by Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report about this very thing.
There's counties where they had more votes than registered voters in the county.
She's saying she's not doing this for Hillary Clinton, the Democrats. Basically, the reason she's doing this is for the integrity of voters and U.S. elections, which are some of the most flawed and anti-democratic in the industrialized world, and even more so in some lesser developed countries. I mean, we've got massive voter suppression, massive voter disenfranchisement, and yes, massive election fraud going back to at least the 2000 presidential election.
Oh, yeah, and by the way, folks, I'd like to remind you that you can go to change.org and find a petition to ask the electors to change their votes to keep Trump out of office. Okay. Not, you know, I'm not a big Democrat or definitely Hillary Clinton backer, but Matt, I really appreciate my Medicare and Social Security, and I feel like that there has to be some kind of stop there somewhere.
It seems that there's talk that the Electoral College people will do it anyway, unless Trump's conflict of interest businesses aren't sold.
Really?
Well, then there's also
that's the talk now.
The Electoral College, large reason for it was to prevent a Donald Trump. And it's really weird because it's kind of working out the opposite the way it was intended. Exactly. They were afraid that a demagogue would get a really huge popular vote and get in, and that they could save us. Instead, the popular vote went to the other imperialist.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, that might be a little nicer on my Social Security and Medicare,
at least for now,
and keep the prevailing wage, and
at least for now
unemployment insurance.
Yeah, at least for now. I mean, that's the thing, is that's the difference between the two. And one, it's like the difference of being slowly strangled to death by somebody from behind whispering in your ear that I'm your friend.
Well, see,
I'm
but helping I
you or somebody coming at you with a machete
is how we set up our worker owned and operated firms and have them federated and work everything out instead of crap like Social Security. I mean, that should just be assumed.
Yeah.
You know, well, in a sane, decent society.
Absolutely.
Populated by decent people.
Yeah.
Indeed. Okay, on that note, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community station WRFU Radio Free Urbana. Stay tuned for the Union Edge. Until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.